Okay, by my watch, it is 5 o'clock or 1700 hours. So let's get started. I'm excited. Storage is something that I'm pretty passionate about. I'm passionate about a lot of things with technology. Storage is one of them. And if you sit and you ask anyone on the Windows Server product team, what are the biggest areas of change that exist in Windows Server 2012? And they're probably going to say virtualization. That's a no-brainer. You guys have probably been to the virtualization sessions already. Game-changing stuff in there. Next up to that is storage, in my opinion, because it underlays and undercuts everything else that's being used. And so I picked this session to talk about for storage. And also the next one that people will talk about is networking. Networking has some very major changes too, and I have two more sessions on networking. So there's actually a lot of stuff that I'm talking about that I'm very passionate about this week. There's a couple that I'm not, and I'm looking squarely at you, Peter. The ones that I am that we're going to have a lot of fun with, and this is one, and this is storage. So this is the Canadian room. It's the Canadian room because it's 1A to get in. My name is Rick Claus. I'm a senior technical evangelist, and I do have one. If you've seen me last year, I had a big stick about being Canadian and that sort of stuff that was going on. I'm going to save you guys the stick. I want to cut right to the meat because there's lots of meat in this one here. But what I will mention is the fact that I still have some Canadian wares to give away. So I have three larger than shots. I'm not going to call these bar shots. I would call these Australian bar shots of maple syrup for the best questions. Not just t-shirts, but actually maple syrup. Now, when I brought these out in New Zealand, actually I was accused as being part of a conspiracy ring of thieves. Believe it or not, the week that I left to go to New Zealand, there was a break-in to the Canadian maple syrup reserve that is housed in Quebec, and 30 million liters of maple syrup was stolen. And I will go on record as saying these three two-ounce bottles, or these three, how many, 40 milliliter bottles, are not from that stolen crop. And if you don't believe me, here is the news article that actually talks about it. And the funny thing is, you know, people have reserves of important things. The United States has this big oil reserve that they're concerned about. What does Canada have? Maple syrup. It's maple syrup reserve. 160 million liters is in our reserve. We lost 30 million of those with a particular stash in the north of Quebec. So this is clean. You're good. But I'm here to talk about storage. Storage is something, as I mentioned, that undercuts every single other thing that you do with servers, because generally when you have a server, you have to have a processor, you have to have RAM, and you have to have some kind of storage that you're talking to. And I'd like to just do a quick little survey of hands in the room so far here, if you could, for who here manages a SAN environment back in their office. If you're a SAN administrator, look at that, almost everybody that's in here is a SAN administrator. You guys can all go, because this is about storage, not just SAN stuff. I'm just joking. Just joking. But you'll see a lot of stuff that you're probably familiar with. For those that don't have a SAN, put up your hands if you do not currently have a SAN, but you want one. Put up your hand. You can be proud. That's good. That's good. Why don't you have one? Money, cost, administration, skills, that sort of stuff. All completely valid points for why you don't have one. Maybe the size doesn't warrant for the size of your organization, that sort of stuff. Well, I'm going to show you some very, very cool stuff that you can do with a couple of different technologies together to get you very advanced storage capabilities for everyone. Doesn't matter if you have a SAN or not. It doesn't matter if you have locally attached disk. And the coolest thing, this even goes down to the client system. So even if you have a tablet, you can do some of the stuff that I'll be talking about today. That's how scalable this stuff is when we talk about storage. So very, very cool stuff is going to be inside here. So a marketing slide just to kind of show you a little bit about this. The idea is that after leaving this session, you'll be absolutely wowed and amazed that you'll want to go out and invest in Server 2012, mainly because it's going to be able to give you storage virtualization and resiliency, as well as next generation scale and availability, which basically covers off your heartstrings, which are attached to CapEx and also attached to availability. The reality is it's just damn cool, and you can do it, and it doesn't matter what kind of system that you're using it for the storage platform. So traditional storage, a little bit of history background here for a lot of people, is that you would have on a traditional side of things a large chunk of disk that you have access to. Maybe you're attaching up to it through a fiber channel array with multiple HBA cards. Maybe you're attaching up to it using an iSCSI connection, which became more popular in the last couple of years. Actually, I did a session on iSCSI last year, talking about how you can use it and how it's now available. Well, iSCSI is now available still within the main server OS, instead of having to do an add-on and a download to be able to use it. Very, very cool stuff. But you have traditional access that's either going to be a block-level access back into your server, or you're going to mount that up and show it as actual file access, like a share NAS device or whatever it happens to be, that your users can use. So you're going to have the application servers running their workloads, whatever those workloads are, attached up to locally attached disk or to a shared SCSI array or to a network shared SCSI array that you have access to it. And then the other option is with file access that you basically will be talking to an intermediary. So it'll be another server that serves it up to you through a file share that's out there. So I was talking to the HP guys downstairs, and they currently have a very nice setup of a 5U 35-drive JBOD setup, so a tray of disk, that they have then plugged into directly a couple of blades. And on those blades, they're running their iSCSI software. And then they're presenting that out to the different candidates that want to use it. That's the way they've set up their system like that, as one option. So we'll go through all the different ways you can set this up. But this is kind of what we're talking about today, is this new way of doing stuff that you can now do with Server 2012, which is going to be going with a cost-effective storage model using something called storage spaces and other things like that. Right off the bat, storage spaces. Storage spaces is a technology that I mentioned is available both on the client side. I think there's actually some good tweets talking about the client aspect of using storage from a previous session to this one here. Storage spaces is available also on the server. Storage spaces is available on Standard Edition and Data Center Edition. Do you guys remember from the earlier discussions what the differences are between the functionality of Standard Edition and Data Center Edition? Anybody? Memory, VMs. Thank you. Yes, absolutely nothing is different functionally between the limits of what's available in Standard and what's available in Data Center. The only difference is the licensing rights for virtualization. So all the stuff I'm showing you right now, you can do with an off-the-rack shelf, off-the-shelf rack of servers, that's what I was trying to say, of systems that's running just with simply Server Standard Edition installed on them. This also could be inside your dentist office. This could be inside your lawyer's office. This could be inside your home office, all the way up to the big guys with multiple racks and racks and racks of servers. So that's the scalability nature of it. Storage spaces basically gives you this category of highly capable storage solutions that give you lower price points and operational efficiency. Let's cut through the BS and actually look at this, which is simply, it gives you cost-effective business-critical storage from the point of view of pools and also storage spaces. So here's the analogy for how this works. Doesn't matter if it's direct attached or not. You have your CPU, your memory, and the chassis for what is your server. You then have storage, which is locally attached to that system. You then have the ability to have multiple drives attached to that system. And then the ways you connect those local drives, well, going down to the smallest thing, could be a USB connection drive. Could be an IDE connection, could be a SATA connection, could be a shared SAS, or could be a regular SAS connection. Doesn't matter how you connect it up. You've got access to disk that you can then include inside this thing. Those things are going to be organized as a unit of aggregation, which is known as a pool of disks. So when I go into my storage environment, I simply say, make me a new pool, please. And then you highlight the different disks that you want to have. And then you say, make me that pool. Great. First step done. Inside that pool, you're then going to have storage spaces. Storage spaces is where you carve up that disk to be able to have different types of protection available and performance available to you to then carve out to the operating system with volumes. And so looking at the commodity storage, this literally is commodity. This could be SAS drives that are on the system directly through a different type of an array, a SCSI array. This could be USB connected drives, could be SATA drives, doesn't matter. And then you also have the option of going with enclosures. The important thing I need to stress with this is if you're going to go out and buy servers going forward from now on, you now get to make the choice, am I going to present this storage as raw disk up to my servers, or plug it directly into my servers, or present this on the network to my servers directly, or am I going to stick something in front of it, like an iSCSI termination point, and then serve those up to the individual systems? And what I'm talking about here is going directly in or network connecting in to this shared storage for the way this works. And so before anyone asks me the question, if you're now going and buying servers and they have like a RAID array on them, like a RAID controller card, should I go in and carve up my system and take my 10 disk and make it into one ginormous volume as a RAID 5 mirrored to make it RAID 10? And the answer for storage spaces is no. Leave it as 10 individual disks, and you'll see why coming up. Any questions so far? Business critical storage, cost effective? I'm not recommending enterprise-wise you go ahead and start buying a whole new set from what's the Future Shop equivalent here in Australia? In New Zealand, it's Dick's. What is it here? Just like every day you want to go off and buy like a USB-connected 3-terabyte drive, where would you go? Okay, all of those? No, I don't recommend that you go off and buy three-terabyte drives and plug them into your enterprise servers and surf it up. You could. I don't recommend it, just to be on record. There was a question over here, though. Yes, sir. Great question. Does it need to be the same type of disk, same performance, same style of disk? And the answer is absolutely not. Although, obviously, you're going to be performing at the level that you purchase for lowest common denominator. And this is way more than simply you in the old days with NT4 going and selecting three different drives and then, say, make a RAID set. Software-based RAID? This is not software-based RAID. This is not software-based parity. This is completely different from what we're doing with this. So here's the model I already explained to you. Basically, at the very bottom of this screen, you have the JBOD trays. These are trays of disk. In this case, you've got, let's say, 60 disks in a 5U tray that are different types of drives, commodity drives. You then carve up those commodity drives. In this case, they happen to be network shared storage for JBODs. Anyone know what JBOD stands for? Just a bunch of disks. Yes. So you carve these up into pools. Pools of disk, which is known as virtualized resilient storage. And then on top of that, you then create volumes. It's not visible to the operating system to be used by applications until you make these volumes, and then you format them with a file system. And then the different applications can use them. And notice the applications we're talking about for workloads. Storage, file services, different file systems, virtualization, different protocols to access it with SMB, 3 and that sort of stuff. It's all independent. It all works. It's not a limiting factor for choosing this. And then above that, you got your physical systems and even virtualized systems that are going off and collecting this. That's how this all works together. In this case, I'm looking at a shared network storage. And I'll talk more about the architecture coming up. Actually, it's this slide right here. So you've got a SAS-connected controller, multiple SAS controllers, talking to a chunk of disk down below as one way of doing it. Or you have multiple servers, which is very cool, talking to all the trays, and with Server 2012, they actually have access to all the disks simultaneously if you set it up the right way. So very, very powerful stuff to have it set up as a shared SAS environment. So the capabilities that we're looking at from a shared storage space perspective is the fact that it's supposed to be and is optimized, flexible. You get to decide how you carve this up to get better utilization of your drive resources. It's resilient to drive failure, should you choose in that kind of fashion, and I'll show you how that actually works. Very, very cool stuff. Operational-wise, it's very simple. And the big thing to notice here is the fact that you'll be using a single tool. Which tool do you think you'll be using to be able to manage all your storage? Actually, it's two tools, yes. PowerShell was one of them. Server Manager is the other one. Gone is the days where you have to know how to configure different types of controllers with web-based interfaces to talk to different types of enclosures, to use Blackmagic to get everything all to work. It's now just a single set of tool that you're used to using, Server Manager, and possibly automation going through with PowerShell in the back end. High availability, scalability, and workload optimized. We'll talk about that in the upcoming slides. So the first off is, think about this. Now again, if you are currently a person that administers storage inside your environment, a SAN environment, this probably isn't new to you. If you're not used to managing individual SAN type of environments, this could be used to you. The idea is that you're going to be able to get cloud-like capabilities of dynamically expanding resources as required, being warned ahead of time that you're starting to consume too much. You can even fake it out and say it's larger than it is, And then as you get close to the maximum, add some more disk in. The idea is that you have the ability to go in and do what's known as a trim provisioning. Sorry, not trim. Thin provisioning of your volumes when you create your volumes. So I literally can go off and say, you know what? We got a new server in today. We got a whole whack of storage with it. I'm going to impress my boss. I'm going to make a 500 terabyte file store. And you can, even if you only have 350 gig SAS drive, or solid-state drives. It'd be really fast. But as soon as you filled up close to the max, you come into a problem. And you have to provision some more disk to be able to add into it. The idea is that literally you have the ability to have an elasticity to this because you can easily add more disk into this. In this case, you've got 36 terabytes across 72 disk. The neat thing is also because you can carve up the pools any way you like, you can literally have a group responsible for this pool of drives, and that's what they paid for. And then the other group is responsible for their pool of drives, and that's what they paid for. And then if you need to, you can always truck in some more disk to go from 72 disks up to 96 disks, where you go up to 48 terabytes. Just as simple as adding them in. Provided your system supports hot pluggable drives, there's not even a reboot of the system, not even a rebuilding of the drive. There's no longer rebuilding of mirrors, rebuilding of parity. It does it for you as part of storage spaces. Is that not cool? That's awesome. I told you, I like storage. Storage Optimizer also goes in and kicks in on a regular basis. Optimizer basically goes around to reclaim space that it can from different volumes that don't need anymore, because volumes can expand and contract as they need to. If they contract back, they still are occupying the space. The Optimizer will go and reclaim that space. And also on more advanced systems like, in this case, Hyper-V, you can actually go back and reclaim dynamically expanded drives and that shrink again. You can reclaim that space as well. Very, very cool stuff. Now, how is this resiliency working here? Well, basically, you go in and you take your drive of pools. You take your pool of drives. I need a drink of water, I guess. I'm getting tongue-tied already, and it's not even 15 minutes into this. You take your pool of drives, and you allocate it, and you set it up when you make your spaces. And you choose to make your space resilient or not. By choosing, is it going to be one that's simply made for parity, which is going to be similar to RAID-type technology, or is it going to be mirrored, in which case you choose to have chunks of the drives mirrored on other drives as opposed to being striped across. The resilient storage takes place because with mirroring, it's going to go in and do some dirty region tracking. As it goes in and writes to the file, it's going to make sure it's able to do it. As it can, it writes to the other one. And then parity spaces uses integrated journaling. So if there happens to be an error in operations or a restart, it can replay that journal to be able to get those files back out again. We're not even talking about the file system yet. This is how this works with the power loss or when the disks are online. So cool stuff there. HotSpare shouldn't be anything that's all that new to you, the concept of what a HotSpare is. The idea is that you can have multiple drives. Now you can actually have five and more drives involved in a mirror set. And then you have the ability to survive two or more drive failures. And it basically, as the drive fails, it brings in the hot spare and then actually gets the good portions of the drive that was dead from the other drives that are currently working and then reestablishes the mirror on the fly on that new drive that comes in. Again, stuff that you probably are familiar with hearing if you currently administer storage. Now, from a simplicity perspective, again, you're going to be using either PowerShell or you're going to be managing this with Server Manager. And the neat thing is that when you provision these different pools of drives, you make these different spaces, it actually is enclosure aware. Because picture this. Say we had an enclosure of, or two enclosures of multiple disks. If I make a mirror a mirror space for my creation of my resilient storage, instead of taking two drives from the same enclosure and then making that mirror, it's actually going to take one drive from one enclosure, one drive from the other enclosure, to try to limit the dependency on a single point of failure. And it does that automatically. Same thing when it goes off and spreads the parity stripe across the different systems. Same sort of thing. So it's enclosure aware. It also is very granular. So in this case, you've got one overall storage person, which is just an administrator of the server, that has the ability to go off and to do all this work that I'll be showing you using Server Manager. And they have the ability to go in and say, you know what? I need to carve this up because I happen to be dealing with administrators that are at the departmental level, one looking after company A, one looking after company B. So actually you can go ahead and make a tenant administrator, which is simply just an access control list for who can go in and to make new spaces. You carve up the pools of the drives. They go in and make the spaces on top of those pools. And then you have the ability to also make an individual space administrator for that actual volume. So you got three different levels of delegation, should you choose to use it. The default is you just have one, which is the main guy at the bottom. You just simply need to have administrative access on that individual server. Anything as well as from a storage perspective for those other guys, they don't have to be domain admins. They could be just regular Joe Blow whoever's that have the RSAT tools installed that are then attached up to the servers they have the appropriate rights to and can manage the storage without having administrative rights because they've been delegated the proper rights that's there. Flexible, granular, as you wanted to have it, you choose it for how you design your storage. Now, from a hardware investment, someone asked me, should I be using all the same type of drive? And the answer is maybe-ish, sort of, because it depends on how you want to design your systems. Picture having an environment where you have some very expensive, very not so high a density, but very high I.O. Solid-state drives. You group those guys together into a pool. You then set it up to be a resilient system by having it set up as being parodied or having it be mirrored, whatever it happens to be for your workload. Then you have another section of that JBOD where you happen to have a bunch of 15,000 RPM disks, your workhorse for the bulk of stuff that's out there. You can have that set up as another pool. And then you make a space on top of that. And then the last one is you got 72,000 RPM archival disks if you wanted to for the old slow small stuff, like home directories or something like that. You can have that guy carved up as well. You carve them up logically as you need to inside your enclosures, again, using the same interface that I'll be showing you here, which is Server Manager. And then you can present this out to the operating system and kind of classify it yourself as being, this is my gold disk, this is my silver disk, this is my bronze disk, this is my loser disk. You get to choose it. You guys are tough. You're not taking any of my jokes. Come on. Nice. So how to set this up with a standalone server. Literally, it's simply a low number of individual servers, each with directly attached storage. There's no external drives involved. It's all simply whatever you can shove inside the case, and that's it. And that generally will work for most environments to give you the level of resilience that you want. However, obviously, if you start to lose your controller on that one box, you're out of luck. And it can definitely work for various different sizes of organizations that might fit yours or might not, because you don't have to design it this way. In this case, you could have it set up and even talking to two different JBOD devices if you wanted to. You can have three spaces that were created to look after those different workloads. Very, very simple sort of stuff. I'm surprised no one's asked me a question yet about performance. How much does this have an overhead on performance over top of having access to the raw disk? And so we did an example for this particular white paper research that we did to be able to publish our stats. This is based on developer preview numbers. In this case, it's a standalone 2U rack server, a Dell R710 that has a dual controller card, SAS controller card, into a tray of disk. In this case, it's 12 bays of JBOD disk, nothing else presented in front of it, 15,000 RPMs. Now, with that particular configuration set up in a storage space, you basically have green is storage space, blue is native access to the disk itself. For different types of workload transactions. And this would be either read throughputs that's doing 1 meg sequential reads, 1 meg sequential writes on the other side, on the top right-hand side for throughput. You guys can read the slide. Basically, it's negligible for what you get from a power being able to do this with storage from a performance perspective. The important part here is notice this doesn't plateau. This is linearly tracking the number of spindles that you add in your storage spaces. Important to see that. Cluster storage spaces, that's when you get up to another cooler element of things, where basically you can now start to have multiple servers with a shared SAS connection or multiple shared SAS connections into these trays of drives. Now, the neat thing with this is that you can get pretty enterprise-level complex if you wanted to and still not have to worry about having a SAN architecture in place. So basically, in this case, you've got 2 to 4 servers that are connected up to a bunch of shared SAS storage that is out there that now becomes a new way of thinking. Because you set these guys up with clustering, basically, with a clustered shared volume at the very top, and then you present that clustered shared volume out to your applications. You can run SQL directly off of an SMB file share. You can run Hyper-V workloads directly off of a file share, SMB3 file share, and have phenomenal performance because of what you can now do with multipath I.O. and also with multiple sessions connections with SMB3. So phenomenal performance here. Now flip this because I'm an architect. an enterprise architect in my past life. Flip this another way around. Think of this as if it was a cloud-based OS built from a cloud up. This is a compute unit now. You start off with this level of a workload. And as that workload gets taxed, you can expand on this. How many nodes can you have in a cluster? 64 nodes in a cluster. This can grow up to 64 nodes in size to be able to support different workloads as your storage starts to get under strain or as you get more compute issues that come up there. Because you can also move that high availability workload off to a different cluster node for maintenance without any disruption whatsoever. And it also becomes resilient if a particular node goes down because SMB3 allows you to maintain open handles on different nodes of that cluster with active-active. So this starts to look very interesting from an architecture perspective. So blow that out even more. Those compute nodes now becomes your continuously scalable environment serving up these different workloads, and you simply copy-paste. Well, I wish it was so easy, eh? You can literally just go in and add in more nodes that are your standard purchase price to be able to go off and get this level of expansion for your different workloads. And they expose out the different pools of storage spaces, and then you go off and you run your different shared namespace, and then go off and share it off to everybody else. Very, very cool. Blow this up one more level, and how do I design this from a networking perspective? Well, here's an example of a deployment element of having your servers, in this case, four servers, and then four trays of disk. The important thing here is that you've got four cards in each one of those servers, and they're color-coded, and they basically represent multiple paths to the same set of drive trays. And then these could be Mellanox controllers, these could be 10 gig E controllers, these could be 1 gig controllers if you're on a budget, these could be InfiniBand, these could be the Mellanox that are 56 gig connections into your systems. The sky's the limit for what you want to build. And then you simply ensure that you got two connections through alternate switches for redundancy into each of those different drive bays. Because most of those drive bays generally have between 6 and 10 connections on the back of them if they're a JBOD device. Pardon me? Great question. How do you handle the multipathing? You can come to my session tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning and find out. Because I'll be talking about multipathing I/O for SMB and as well as NIC teaming as well. But generally speaking, you simply handle from the physical connections, make sure you have two switches that are separate from each other, and you have one connection off of the server going into one switch, and then that switch has one connection down into your different drive bay, and then you have one in the separate switch going down to the drive bay as well. And then the OS is multipath aware and knows it can get to the server through different redundant paths. Yeah, so the OS knows this now. The question was, isn't this all just really a SAN? I'll ask it back to you. Is this a SAN? It's just a bunch of disks with network connectivity with no extra intelligence to it except for the operating system. You're missing a big chunk of other stuff because all you're doing is you're presenting these disks to the OS with an abstracted form. Aren't we just putting that into the OS? You'll see. I'll put this another way. The difference is you didn't get that on the recording. So here's an example with this particular setup. You could have 3 terabytes set up on these guys with actual hard drives from a capacity perspective. If you work out the math of 60 drives per setup times 4 times 3 terabytes, blah, 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 720 terabytes of storage in this particular deployment unit in one 4-node cluster. You could have 600 SAS drives that are hard drives that are 15,000K for mid-level performance and get 144 terabytes. And my personal favorite, 400 gigabyte SSDs for 96 terabytes of blisteringly eye-burning fast I/O in a compute unit. Eye-burning fast. You can quote that one. Fire-breathing dragon, yes. Fire-breathing dragon burning fast I/O into your deployment unit. And what happens when you start to have a capacity issue? Buy another deployment unit. Plug it into the cluster. Add it in. Boom. Done. Sweet. We took this to the extreme at Microsoft from a testing perspective to be able to say, okay, what does this look like if you actually spun this out to all 64 nodes? Unfortunately, they didn't let me touch it or bring it to Australia. This is what it looks like. Four 42U racks fit all of that infrastructure to be able to handle 16 deployment units of four servers apiece with 64 nodes of a cluster with one JBOD per individual server connection, giving you approximately 242 hard disk drives and also SSD drives, which gives you approximately four 40 gig Mellanox controllers ports into each of those different JBODs and those servers for running a total of 4,000 virtual machines. Four racks of servers at a fraction of a cost of what you would pay for other solutions that are out there. That's all I can say. Storage Spaces gives you a new category of highly capable storage solutions that allow all Windows customer segments to dramatically lower price points and maximize operational simplicity. I'm assuming that you guys are probably sick of looking at these slides and that you're interested in taking a look at some of this. And so before I go on the next section, why don't I just show you how easy it is to make a storage space. Is that something you guys want to see? Okay. Now, I kind of, you know, let the cat out of the bag that I don't have any really massive amounts of storage behind me and behind the curtains. I'm not going to do this magical reveal, unfortunately. So just give me a second here, and I've got a connection here. That's good. That's good. And switch to number 7. You guys should see this. Okay. So this is a virtualized environment. This is to show you how easy this is. And again, remember, that 64-node cluster that had all that disk inside of it is the same technology you could use on a Samsung tablet with three USB 3 drives connected to it. Same technologies powering that all the way up on the server side to that size of a scale of an infrastructure. In this case, I got two machines. I got a WSUS server, and I got a domain controller inside this one particular demonstration network. Clicking on the fast and fluid environment of my canvas, which is Server Manager, as I spew out all the possible buzzwords that I can, notice how it dynamically changes to show me just the volumes that I care about inside my environment. And the neat thing I like about this is that you can actually see the volumes across all of your systems that you have included. So again, very, very cool single point of management on my system. I'm going to start down at the lowest level for storage pools. And you'll see over here that I happen to have three drives that are 127 gigabytes each, and that's it. These ones actually happen to be even virtual disks to make it even smaller that are out there. I just simply go in here to the very top, and I say, you know what, let's go ahead and make a new storage pool that I want to do. Simple wizard interface. It's going to allow you to make the first level of storage pools. I'm going to go in and give this a name. Gold Coast pool of disks located on that server. And then I choose the disks that I want to have available in this. I'm just going to choose these two. I could choose one and have it as a hot spare, but for this demo, I'm just going to leave it as it is, selecting two, because I've got to build up my demo for the next one. And I'm going to set them up for automatic as well, for automatic usage. If you left them all to automatic, one would default over to a hot spare. And then it says, okay, looks like it's all done. Does that look like it's what you want to do, which gives you a total capacity of 254 gigabytes? Absolutely. Go ahead and say create. And it goes off and does it for you. It doesn't care what controller card you're using, how it's connected, what speed it is. It just simply does it for you. And then don't forget this right here. It simply goes in and says, create a virtual disk when this guy closes, which is the next obvious step. So far, the OS doesn't really know too much about the storage space, the pool of drives and the fact that it's created. So another warning, I hit next. This is the pool of disks that I can go off and configure because it has available space. I hit next. And this is where I'm going to go off and create my storage space as in the form of a virtual disk. A virtual disk abstracts it to allow me to expand and contract it as I want to. This is going to be my TechEd vdisk. Create it. And this is where I get to choose what it's going to be. It's either going to be a mirror, which is what I'm going to use, which is simply two or three physical disks increasing reliability. It also gives you reducing capacity because you actually have to do one-to-one relationship. The layout requires at least two different disks to protect it from a single disk or more to be able to, five, to do two disks configuration. You also could choose parity where it basically just stripes parity across the different drives. I'm going to choose a mirror because I only have two disks to use this with. And then here, neat thing I like is I'm going to go off and use thin provisioning, where I can fake it out. The reason why I want to fake it out is because it's similar to how I like to explain. We just recently moved to the States, and my wife is excited because the house that we rented has a walk-in closet. And the problem with closets is that it has a finite amount of space. And no matter how much stuff you have, it's always going to fill up the closet. Even if you you garage sale half of it away, it's going to come back again and fill it up again. Same thing with drives and with storage. Thin provision this, and I'm going to say, you know what? Let's make this into a 500 terabyte drive with only 227 gig drives inside of it. One second. And then go ahead and create it. It goes ahead and finishes that off. Yes, sir, quick. Differences between parity and mirror. What kind of difference of performance are you going to be able to see? You're going to, just like with traditional mirrors, you're going to get better performance off of a mirror. With parity, you're going to get a degradation in performance because it has to go off and calculate and create that parity as it goes off and writes. So it's going to slow it down. Does that answer your question? I'm not going to give you exact numbers because I don't have the numbers to give you. I'm sorry. That's the real reason. Notice at the bottom over here, it's going to say create a volume when it closes. Last wizard. So in case you haven't noticed, Jeff is going to be talking about this more in his session tomorrow about storage spaces, is the fact that we're chaining these wizards together to make it easy. Here we go. Hit next. This is my server I want to talk to. This is my new 500 terabyte disk that I'm going to carve up. I wish I had 500 terabytes at home. Now you can have 500 terabytes at home. I want to make this one here as a 250 terabyte volume. And I'm going to call it, in this case, N. And I'm going to call this guy NTFS with a smaller allocation unit size. And he's going to be called NTFS data for obvious reasons that you'll see in just a moment. I'm going to say create. It goes off and makes this. Notice I haven't had a drop down to any web page, any configuration, any extra software. It's just this. It could have entirely been command line PowerShell, but I would probably fudge the command lines to tell you how to type it correctly. So that one disk is now created up above. You can now see that I have one TechEd vDisk, which is 500 terabytes, that is now there. And inside of it, I have one volume that is a thinly provisioned 250 terabyte. Let's make a second volume for my demo coming up in just a little bit. Use that same guy. Use 250 terabytes. In this case, he's going to be called R. If I can hit R, there we go. And he's going to be REFS. Notice one thing happened here. That's grayed out. Do you guys care about having DOS 622 file names 8.3 length anymore? Hopefully not. If you do, we have another conversation about supportability we should probably talk to you about, or 16-bit applications. You cannot have 8.3 short file names on our EFS volume. I'm going to call this guy REFS. Hit next. Hit create. And it goes off and makes it. End result. What does this look like? Close. Done. If I go back to my volumes, I now have on my domain controller one fixed volume of 127 gigs. On my ASUS box, I happen to have the C drive, as well as two 250 gig drives, 250 terabyte drives, sorry, which looked like this. Those are great numbers. Take a screenshot of that, take it back to your boss, say, look, I just tripled our storage. That's cost savings right there. We deleted all the files off our servers, got all the room back. So that is how easy it is to make a space. It's that simple. And it didn't matter how those disks were attached. They could have been USB connected, could have been SAS, could have been SATA, could have been IDE, could have been whatever you want, as long as you have access to it. And once again, the best way to do this for the optimal configuration by the operating system is to not pre-carve up your drives as a single RAID parity volume with the controller cards on your system. Leave it just as the raw drives, and that's it. The question is, can you create volumes off of the vDisk of the other server? The answer is no. If you had shared SAS storage, you would be able to see the pool together between all the different systems, and they would simply attach into and talk to that individual space. We'll talk about that a little bit coming up. So Now, if I go in here, start up a command prompt. Set up another command prompt. And I'll just make this guy a little bit bigger so you guys can see him. Try that a little bit more. I'm going to use this one in my next demo coming up in just a little bit. So we have two different colors, and you'll see why in just a moment. So that is as quick as it can be for understanding the concept of the architecture of how storage spaces works. It literally is taking pools of drives that you've created by some characteristic that makes sense to you. You've carved them up and you've exposed them into a set of virtual disks, which is known as your storage space. That virtual disk, I'll get both of you in just a second. The virtual disk basically is where you put on your layer of resilient storage. Is it going to be for speed, which is simply striped? Is it going to be parity, or is it going to be mirrored, and that sort of stuff? And then you expose that to the operating system as volumes. Yes, sir. Yeah, so great question. Basically, you've just seen me do this all through a GUI environment. Is there a way of being able to capture the PowerShell scripts to be able to do that? No. But you can do everything I just did entirely with PowerShell on your Windows 8 box, talking to the remote storage on the server if you wanted to. And there is a good blog about that. I have a question here or a comment from Mr. Alexander. Oh, nice. So you get the GUI-friendly way now, and then you show the real way how to do it later. That's what you're saying? Nice. So here comes REFS. Oh, sorry, the second question. Yes, sir. So the question was, if I have a resilient storage space, which is based on parity and striping, and I bring in a couple of new disks and add into the pool, am I able to reestablish the parity on that? And the answer is yes. And it does it for you when you add the disks. And it does it while the disks are online. So you don't have to worry about, it basically shuffles stuff around with the optimizer while it's online. So you don't have to worry about taking this thing offline and rebuilding it again. I think I got one more up there and I got to keep on going. Yeah. The question is with 7 and with Vista. I get a shudder when I say that. You had disk parts. Does this take over disk part? And the answer is disk part's still there. You can still use it for basic drive configuration, but you cannot go off and... can you? I'm pretty sure you do not have the ability to control that through disk part specifically because it's an executable file. You could do this through PowerShell stuff instead of using disk part. But disk part's still there. It's not like if you're in the Active Directory session with Peter where he went over and took AD prep in the corner and shot it. We didn't do that. Disk part's still there. So, resilient file system, REFS. It's a new file system. First off, we didn't take everything that we learned with NTFS and throw it out the window. We're building on top of that. So it is a new file system. It's not a V2 of NTFS. It's different with the way that it functions at the lowest levels. That gives you a significant ability to improve upon future innovations that come out in storage. These very aspirational statements. You can tell a marketing person made this deck. It's available, it's scalable, it's cost efficient. So let's talk about the design aspects of this. The idea when we created REFS, REFS basically came down from the file system guys, and the idea was to make a file system similar to what you'd be using in a cloud environment. One thing that you work with in a cloud environment on a very large data center and very large massive scale is that you design your systems with the understanding that the underlying technology those systems run on will absolutely fail at some point. So how do you deal with that with the way that you do all your types of transactions? And so from an integrity perspective of that data, we go off and we look after, for instance, metadata corruption is detected when you are using REFS. And potentially you can turn on this level of integrity check-in also for user data as well. From a scalability perspective, I forgot one point there. REFS for the resilient file system is going to be building on top of using storage spaces. It's not a mandatory requirement. You can make a static volume and simply make it as REFS and you're good to go, but it's not going to get as much benefit as using a storage space underneath it. I'm going to be using the storage space that I created to show you a really cool demo at the end of this for REFS. Let me come up to scalability, because obviously we had an upper limit for how big you can get with NTFS volumes. Anyone know what the upper limit of the NTFS volumes were? Peter, I'm looking at you. You must know. Come on. Pardon me? Was it 16 exabytes? I knew it was in the exabyte range, but I forgot because it's been so long. But anyway, it's in the exabyte size of things. And you're not going to answer it? No, I can't win anything. Scalability-wise, this was built to be able to go well beyond that. And when I say well beyond it, think about your storage requirements in the next 5 years with the rate that storage is growing right now. What's it going to be? 7 years out, what's it going to be? Huge. So just from a very simple measurement of how to be able to explain this, how many files can you have in a single directory on an REFS volume in one single directory? What do you think? Here's my question. This is for maple syrup. 2^128 is incorrect. I'm sorry. You will have the ability... to have this many files inside a single directory with the addressing space that we use for handling that. The question is, who can tell me how to say this number? Who wants to try? Anybody? Someone says trillion, quadrillion. Come on. Who what? Quintillion. Well, you were in my session in New Zealand. I can't give you the maple syrup for that one there. It is 18 quintillion, 446 quadrillion, 744 trillion, 73 billion, 709 million, 551,616 minus one for the actual number of files in a single folder on a single REFS volume. It's massive. It's huge. It's basically 10 to the 64 minus one. 2^64 - 1, not 10^64, 2^64 - 1. It's huge. Availability, REFS maximized daily availability at all times. If corruption occurs and redundant copies is unavailable, the non-corrupt portions will remain unaffected and available online, and then it'll go off and try to sort the sort of stuff out to find the good stuff if it can. Architectural evolution basically is simply building upon our current editions of Windows NT, NTFS to be able to go better, and is going to be working for new storage devices going forward. So let's take a look at this. How does integrity work? One thing that's very important. One of the things that usually can cause an awful lot of data corruption is if you try to access and modify data in place on the local file system, there is a chance it's going to go off and get corrupted. So, in fact, it doesn't do this when it's accessing files for write activity. It actually writes next to it or around it elsewhere and then gets rid of the other stuff as it no longer needs it anymore for the basic idea of how it does its on-write element, of data. Checksums are also used every single time it writes data, not parity, checksums of that metadata and also user data if you turn it on, to basically check and see, has it changed at rest before it was accessed by the system again? In which case it's probably corrupted, and then can go off and fix it. File system metadata is always protected. You turn it on for per volume, per directory, per file basis, because it does take some time to be able to do this. And before anyone asks, what are some limitations of this? You cannot have your boot volume or system partition formatted as REFS. This is for data volumes. It's not for your system partition. Can you have other types of clients talk to REFS volumes through a network share? What do you think? Absolutely. No problem. Does it have to be available, or is this available on 2008 R2? No. This is only available on Windows Server 2012. So, one thing that it does is it has this process with storage spaces working better together on our system, where basically Server 2012 has a process called a scrubber that runs on a regular basis, looking at your metadata and looking at the data that's on the disk. And it reads the data and basically discovers where failures exist on a regular basis. Now, on NTFS, it basically is going to go off and read the environment, verifies that all copies are readable, and then on a failure, NTFS is going to get an alternate copy of the data if it's possible. Whereas REFS is a little bit different. REFS basically is going to go through and detect the problem. It's going to read the data. It's going to validate it against the checksum to make sure it's accurate. it sees that the checksum is wrong because it has changed since it was last written to or read, it then is going to go in and find another copy of that data on one of those other resilient spaces. So basically, it can tell when the data has been corrupted on the disk level itself and then compute the fact that it's bad or has changed and then go off and get a good copy of the data someplace else. And I'll be showing you this. Hang on a second. I'll be showing you this in just a minute. The neat thing about this is that RAFS does this on the fly to be able to do some auto-correction. So let me put this into principle here for you. You know what? I think I'm going to skip to my demo here and show this to you instead to be a bit more impactful. So this is my storage space. I have a thinly provisioned volume that is 250 gigabytes. That is my N drive, which is NTFS. I have a 250 terabyte. And I have a 250 terabyte R drive, which is as REFS. Currently, there's no data on them. It's out there. I want to go in here to a directory structure. And I'm going to say this is my N drive copy on my left. And this is the, if I can get in here, I'm going to say create file, which is my R drive over here. So I'm looking directly at the data and showing you the hex value of that data of a particular file, which is a picture. This is actually a picture that is extremely important to me, because as I was cleaning up my systems and I found my SD cards in my bag up here, I actually happened to find a folder that I had not seen in a while and a picture that I had not seen in a while, which is a picture of myself and my daughter that I don't have another copy of. I just copied that onto my NTFS drive with my N drive. And just to show you over here, MS Paint, in this case it's the R drive, images, image 2, and there it is there of my daughter and hanging on to me. There's no other copy of this data whatsoever that's out there. If I go over here to NTFS and I suffer a catastrophic failure at the file level down at the block of the disk itself, it's going to overwrite that data with other data. I'm willing to guess that you guys are probably able to tell that that data is not going to be too good anymore. If I can type on this side so I can corrupt it on both sides, down to the block, down to the actual file level as well, it's now corrupted. Over here, what's going to happen? Well, I'm going to open it up, and it's going to say, sorry, at the file level, this is corrupted. It is completely dead, no good. I can't do anything about it. You're out of luck. I didn't have a drive failure. I had a sector or a chunk of the block of the file overwritten and bad because it's bad. So now my wife is extremely upset at me because I no longer have that file. What about over here? It's able to detect the fact that the checksum was bad because it was modified without being modified by the file system. It was modified by a bad drive that's in there. And it said, that's bad. Checksum's wrong. Let's go and find another copy of that good stuff someplace else and display that instead. And I'll go back and fix that other stuff and make it so that it's all happy again. That's a clap right there. You know how hard it was to do that? Trying to find some kind of a quantifiable demo to show the resilient nature of REFS is insane. So I'm glad that worked. Phew. Some other cool stuff with NTFS as well. REFS as well. If I go in, you guys remember this one here? Check disk. You guys remember that? Let's go and see erase and see how fast these guys are. CLS. Hang on. So, yeah, I should change that to N, to be fair. No, actually, you know what? I'm going to leave it as C, because C is NTFS as well, and there's more files to make it more realistic on the C drive. Over here, I'm going to say CHK, DSK, R drive, and then, you know what? I'm going to give the C drive a head start. And then over here, I'm going to say Enter. Oh, I'm done already. You got to love an engineer with a sense of humor, eh? So, what does that mean in reality? Anyone ever have a situation where they have a ginormous, massive data store Exchange, that has a problem with the disk. You have to reboot the server, bring it back up again. And all of a sudden, check disk says, oh, that was shut down dirty. Let me take your Exchange server offline for 3 days while I check disk it. Don't have to worry about that anymore. So, built because it was designed to know that the underlying structure will fail. Autocorrection, very, very cool. So scalability, basically how does it do this? RFS is going to be using what's known as a B-tree data structure for its directory structures that's up there for all the metadata to give you the maximum amount of scalability, 2 to the power of 64. File system abstractions are also implemented using the same key-based tables that are used in B-trees. Capacity allocation is handled by a hierarchy of allocations. When you've got this much possible massive amounts of storage, it's not going to use the same allocation blocks to be able to write teeny tiny little files and big huge ones. It's going to use variable length allocations to be able to commit these to the file system. And it just handles it. So again, more efficient. You remember how if you look at the stats for NTFS, you can say wasted space. Under disk management, you can see the amount of wasted space that's not available. You don't have that with RFS. It's much more efficient. Now, I am harking back to the whole concept of this is a new file system. And introducing change to an IT professional's environment is generally something that is, we are very risk adverse, if possible, right? So rest assured that most of the things that we're talking about here will still work with the same standard NTFS and Windows APIs at the upper layers. So almost everything will still work with RFS. That being said, the lower level stuff has changed. And so you do have to be aware of, we're building on top of the 20 years of capabilities of NTFS. It reuses a good level of the upper layer of the APIs, but you still need to test and find out, is it supported, is it not supported, it's out there. Generally, you're going to be looking at this for very large file stores. Lots and lots and lots of files, lots and lots of high availability requirements, so you don't have to worry about doing check disk, and then migrating to this when you go to it. RFS really is about availability and also scale and confidence that it's there. Now, some of the trade-offs. It's certain types of data that is, for instance, on SQL, for instance, like file streams data, not going to work. So talk to your SQL guys and see what they understand about RFS and whether or not you should use it for your SQL environments. Before anyone asks me, can I use this on Exchange? The answer is no, because Exchange is not certified to run on Server 2012 at this point in time. Go see the Exchange sessions later on about what they're saying for future versions. Will this work also if you happen to have any 16-bit programs that need to have 8.3 names? The answer is no, will not work, as I already mentioned. What are some other things? You also have some NTFS-specific stuff. So the NTFS has some index reparsing, name streams, and also the MFT table. Those are no longer supported, no longer required, that are out there. Other thing that's also very important, that's an extremely cool thing that Jeff will be showing you tomorrow, deduplication doesn't work on RFS. You got to stay with NTFS for deduplication. That's good. Hard links don't work, object IDs. And then finally, superseded. In other words, if you need to have per file level encryption, doesn't work on RFS either. It's been replaced by full volume encryption, known as BitLocker. You don't need it anymore, right? Quotas, same thing. Compression, you don't need to worry about compression with these works. So these are just some of the limitations. There is a fantastic white paper on storage that you can download and take a look at the differences. There's a whole section on TechNet just on RFS. It's out there. This is your introduction to it. Go play it and go use it. Invest your time also much more, in my opinion, deeply on storage spaces and what storage spaces can bring you and how that works, and then come back to take a look at RFS. At this point, you're probably not going to have too many point uses of this one here just yet. However, I've got RFS running in my home environment to protect my pictures just for the same reason for the demo that you just saw, because I have experienced drive failures. It's on there. And before anyone asks, how did I do that? It's a special demo utility that I have that's not available to the public, and it actually went down below the file system driver, unsigned, to be able to modify the data directly on the disk. So this is not a normal thing that you'd be able to do. That's why this demo, luckily, happened to work. RFS deployments. As I mentioned, think about this as a cost-efficient way of working with commodity hardware that's out there to be able to set this up. When you're making your deployment elements of multiple JBOD trays, talking to your compute nodes, which is your cluster side of things, you go off and you take your pools of disk and turn them into spaces. Once you've made your spaces, you choose the level of resilient storage you want to have. To do the stuff that I did, which was recover from a corrupted file at the file level, you have to be using a resilient storage space. So again, if you're using a big, huge volume that's abstracted by the RAID controller card, you won't be able to do that. You have to have multiple disks that are out there. And then it goes up to individual stores, and you store them up, and you expose them to the operating system. Failover clustering gives you the high level of high availability. The file level is protected because of RAFS. It's out there. It's only available in 2012. It can only be deployed to a data volume, cannot be the boot or system partition, as already mentioned, and does not guarantee the same level of application compatibility as NTFS does. So do your jurisprudence and do your testing to make sure it's good. I'm going to take a breath. I got a couple of questions I'm sure you guys are dying to ask. Yes, sir. Is it more resilient to fragmentation? I actually haven't done the delved in the research on that one there. Because it is using, when it writes the data, it's not going to write in place. It does move stuff around as required to be able to find a new location to be able to do it. The optimizer and the scrubber take care of keeping things happy for where they are. And because it's using alternate sized allocation blocks as well, when it commits a file, there's less fragmentation of individual files that are out there. But as files grow, you're still going to get fragmentation that takes place. Yes. Yes, sir. The question was, I haven't talked that much about multipathing into SANs and how that's changed. Come to my talk tomorrow, where I talk about how the network stack has changed for multipath I.O., for NIC teaming, and also for SMB access as well. And that's where I talk more about that. Lots of questions up there in the red. The question is, wouldn't you have to still use a hardware level RAID to do resilience level on your volume? And the answer is, with storage spaces, no, because you do the resilient level two levels below that. You carve your individual disks together into pools. You now have allocated number of drives that are going to be hot spares or being used as the actual pool itself. And then you carve that up in individual spaces and choose your resilient level on top of that. This is a big mind shift for people that are administrators setting up servers. This guy on the stage is actually telling you to not use the onboard controller logics and caching to present a volume already up to you. For the boot volume, good question, to elaborate on that question. If it's talking about the boot volume, the answer is absolutely yes. You can either boot from SAN or boot from another iSCSI device, or you could go in and have a mirrored set of SSD drives. It depends on your architecture for the system. Yes, you have to protect your boot level. And also, I haven't already said it, but it should be plain as day, you still have to do backups. You still must back up this data. You don't just have to rely, oh, Rick said it's fine. Don't worry about it. He can get a picture of his daughter off an SD card and it's still there. It's like, no, I didn't say that. So it's good. So yeah, make sure of that. Yes, sir. Yeah, so the question was basically those performance numbers I had up there, what was that based on, how did that work? That was with a 12 bay direct attached storage without going through a controller card, just going through a normal controller card, no extra fun stuff. And then it was a parity space. No, sorry, that one was a mirrored space. And that one there had minimal stuff. And then the question is, what about a parity? How much performance is that when they're going to be? I'm going to refer you back to the white paper on the storage because the numbers that I have is all based on developer preview. So I'm going to say it's negligible. There obviously is an overhead to run a storage space, but the benefits of what you get with it without having to invest the extra cash in the hardware is there. Now, I'm also going to state, does this replace the SANs out there? Absolutely not. They have another market where they play and that sort of stuff that's there, and they absolutely give you additional capabilities, functionalities, and protection that go well beyond what storage spaces can do. And you know, that's another whole discussion for do you get rid of your SANs. I'm not advocating that. You now have another option is what this is about, to be able to do stuff. Yes, sir. Great shirt, by the way. I love Jeep. So the question is, how does it now offset the level of taking away the cache that's on there for the performance that's on that controller card. Yeah. So again, you can't compare this to a SAN configuration for the caching that it does, but for an individual controller card, it's still going to be utilizing that cache, being able to access those drives, just not with the lower level abstraction and protection. So it's still going to use that from a caching perspective, be able to access the drives. So that's still being used. But as far as how does it compare to a SAN, there is no comparison to a SAN because the SAN architecture is completely different than what this is. This gives you industry standard enterprise functionality without having to have higher end hardware. How about if you say that nicely? Storage spaces doesn't do any caching was the question. The answer is it uses whatever the controllers that is on the system to be able to have access to the local system. Above the hardware doesn't do anything. Okay. I got to pay some homage over here to this side. Yes, sir. Can you use the storage spaces with the new Intel SSD caching or with hybrid drives, I'm assuming you're talking about, from a consumer perspective? However that is presented to the BIOS and to the operating system is what is able to be used. And if it does, for instance, I know someone had a question about this with different types of very cheap commodity level drives that have a very long time between failure before they report a failure. How does it work? It depends on the drive. So how long does it wait before it goes off to try to find the data someplace else? So let me wrap up here. I got a couple more sessions, a couple more slides here. You guys are now taking off. For those of you that are leaving to beat the rush, don't forget the evals, please. Thank you. 5 minutes, 10 minutes left. Don't forget evals. So RAFS literally is your new file system you can go off and use as an option. It works in parity with your storage spaces to give you an extra level of resiliency. Hopefully I've opened your mind to a new idea of how you can now build more cost-effective solutions for your customers or for yourself potentially. But again, don't discount the other higher-end stuff that still works from a SAN environment. That's all still there. You are able to obviously do this with commodity hardware. You get what you pay for from a performance perspective, obviously, but it is a way to go off and to minimize CapEx expenditures on your different systems. And then finally, Server 2012 is the most cost-effective platform, yada, yada, yada. You guys don't want to see that. So what are some storage stuff you can take a look at? There's a great white paper with talking about virtualizing storage for scale, resiliency, and efficiency. With a white paper Go link, you can download these slides. They're available to download as of the start of the session. You can also go in and have a nice quick little walkthrough on how to configure a clustered storage space for your compute units, and also a great storage FAQ there as well. If you guys haven't already done so, I strongly urge that you tweet about the helicopter rides because it looks so freaking cool taking off at lunchtime. I unfortunately am ineligible. And I was also told, because someone said that they wanted to win it to be able to give it to me, that they were looking for a guy with a green hat and they will not let me on the helicopter with a green hat. So you just simply tweet, I want to ride in the WinServe heli at autoauteched.coz, auteched because. And then finally, most importantly, evaluations. I truly would like to know how you like the session, if it's mind-changing for you, if you think it's going to be something you can take advantage of. Don't forget, you can do this with your Windows 8 workstations as well to be able to make storage spaces on individual video rendering subsystems, as it will, as an example. You can win a really cool mouse. I don't even have that one yet. I want to get that one. Very cool stuff. To get a hold of me if you're interested, download the files. To get a hold of me if you're interested, my email address is rick.claus@microsoft.com. Hopefully, if the eval scores are good enough, I get to come back. That's my plea. And thank you for taking so much time to come and chat with me. I still have 3 things of maple syrup, so I'll still take some questions. I have 5 minutes left for some questions, but thank you very much for coming down. Yes. Is there a permissions role that takes and does all that delegation, you said? Yeah. Okay, so basically he's asking, is there a way that you can go in and delegate out the ability to go off and to manage spaces? The answer is yes. Default is the administrator. You do have to go down to a lower level to be able to say who can make disk pools, who can make storage spaces on top of disk pools, who can make volumes on top of storage spaces on top of disk pools, and you can carve it up to 3 different layers for delegations out there. That's a maple syrup question. Come on down for maple syrup. And a t-shirt. Nice. I can throw the t-shirt, but I... Almost. You think I was from Australia with a boomerang, eh? You ready for this? Come on down for that. That's there.
I can take it to him if you like.
Yes, right in the front, sir. The question was, are you able to extend the volume that you created inside the virtual disk, which is the space inside the pool, that you created earlier? The answer is no. It can only go as big as what the pool is. Can you create the pool larger? Yes. You can add more disks to the pool and then make the space larger because it's a virtual disk. So basically, the thin provisioning is the ability to go off and to simply say it is a volume that is much larger, but it's made and done. And then you're able to go in and expand the lower level stuff underneath it and then expand that volume once it's already made. Yeah, just like you can extend a volume now, the same thing, extend a volume then. You got it. You're missing out on your maple syrup if you don't come down. I'm not going to throw it at you. I'll give you a black t-shirt for that one there if you're interested. And the maple syrup. There you go, sir.
Love it. Thank you.
You got it. You guys are good. Who haven't I asked yet? The guy in the green shirt. What's the green shirt there? Green hat, green shirt, got to do it. What's up? Yeah. Okay, great. The question was, how does the operating system handle running out of space? If you look at the interface that Jeff is going to be showing you tomorrow for storage spaces, when you look at your volumes on your servers that are file servers, it gives you a little green indicator of how much space you have left that's physically there and how much is available inside the storage space as a whole. You actually get a warning at 85% is when it turns yellow, and then it turns red when you're full or close to being full. So you'll be getting alerts on this lovely canvas that's called Server Manager that'll warn you ahead of time, and you better be paying attention to Server Manager. So basically it warns you ahead of time. It also throws events in the event log too. How about want a black one? There you go. I'm going to take out someone's eye if I throw it. You better come down. Yes, sir. You've been very patient. Is REFS supported with DFS replicas? The answer is it's independent because DFS is an application workload. You're walking away from Canadian maple syrup, dude. That's like leaving beer on the table in Australia. You don't do that at a pub. There you go. Jeez. I like that. So, yeah. Oh, you know what? Good point. That would be a testing. I'll cover my butt and I'll say that's a test. You got to go and test that out. Good point. That's a red one for you, sir. Last t-shirt question. I got to do anyone over here. Yes, sir. Very patient with the red shirt. Can you do a in-place conversion from NTFS to REFS? I actually don't know. I'm going to have to say no because it's a different file system, but you can come down and I can check it out to see what it says. I'm pretty sure you can't do it because it is a completely different file structure, B-tree information. All you do is you create one in parallel and copy it over. That's it. Yeah, good. I got to get out of here in time for Mr. Peter Calvert to go off and talk about Server Manager and goodness there. Thank you very much for sticking around, guys. Don't forget those evals, please. Your shirt, my friend.